Following the government's integrated review of 2020, which recommended a more streamlined and agile military force, medical provision within the British Army is currently being transformed. It is doing this by reorganising the medical services structure as well as repurposing existing medical units. As such, now is an opportune moment to look back as well as forward as the Army refocuses against a backdrop of conflict in Eastern Europe and counter-terrorism more widely. This new series of podcasts takes as its theme the role of the field hospital as a staple of the medical organisation of the British Army over the past 150 years. So far in this series, we have heard from historians and British Army medical personnel about the origins of the field hospital and its organisation, and we have spoken to current members of 22 Field Hospital, based at Keogh Barracks, about their work as a cadre unit. When not on deployment, the field hospital maintains a state of readiness. But what happens when it is deployed? In this episode, we find out what deployed hospital care facilities look like when out in the field, and what elements are required to treat wounded soldiers. We spoke to Major Sean Reeve at 22 Field Hospital, who discusses size and capability when mobilised.
The size of personnel that will make up a hospital is very much dependent on the capabilities that is put out. We have a number of sizes of hospitals, with the smallest hospital that gets put out the door having 17 people, up to a four support hospital, which will see in the region of around 400 to 500 people going out. Currently, in support of the Army Operating Order, we are held at 5 days' notice to move to put out a Role 2 enhanced hospital that will see about 125 to 126 people deployed overseas in response to an activation. Mass deployment. We have a number of options with us with a field hospital, and it's important to distinguish two points. First one is capability. So a capability is what the hospital can do. There are some predefined definitions agreed with NATO and our allied partners as to what a hospital will have in its capability. And this is reflected in the naming of the various different hospitals that are available to us. So our smallest hospital will be known as a Role 2 forward surgical capability. And we go all the way through to a Role 3 for support hospital, its biggest thing. So that's the capability.
So the Role 2 and Role 3 capabilities relate to the different sizes of the field hospital when deployed, giving the Army medical response a degree of flexibility depending on demand. And these can differ between what is known as a forward surgical capability with 17 personnel and a force support hospital with over 450 staff, as well as the Role 2 and Role 3 field hospitals with 37 and 455 personnel respectively. When out in the field, the hospitals are usually, though not always, tented facilities. Sometimes use is made of otherwise unused buildings, but they always feature emergency bays, surgical tables, intensive care beds, and general ward beds. In a tented facility, each section is individually contained, leading off a central corridor rather like fish bones off a spine. Again, Sean Reeve tells us how this works.
The second consideration we need to think about, it's how much or how many patients or casualties that facility can take. Now, with hospitals, there are a lot of numbers that are thrown around with the capability descriptor as well. So you will hear of a Role 2F or Role 2 Forward 1110. So the numbers are important because they are the capacity. So if we think about a normal patient journey in a civilian hospital, someone's been injured, they go in. The first place that they're going to go in is the A&E for a bit of triage, a bit of assessment. So that the first number is the A&E capacity, or for us in the military, it's the emergency department. So you will hear 1110. The first one is the ED or the A&E bed. So this is in the descriptor 1110. It's telling us we have one ED bed. Once that patient has come out of ED or has been assessed in ED, it's just decided that they need some surgery. So we look at the second number within the four number sequence. So if we keep on a Role 2 forward, It's 1110. So the second one is surgery. Okay, how many surgical beds do we have? And in this case, it's one. Once you come out of surgery, the patient is a little bit sick, so needs a bit of intensive care. So we look at the ITU capability, which is the third. How many beds do we have within ITU? And in this case, we have one. So that's one ED, one surgery, one ITU. And then finally, if the capacity is there, we have a general wards. So in the case of a roll two forward, 1110, we have zero general ward beds. But in other capabilities, we have either 6, 12 or 48 beds. So that's the numbering. So two things to take in consideration with hospitals. It's the capability, what does it have, and the capacity, what can it take? If we contrast the capabilities that we have at our disposal, and all of these are found in both of the two regular field hospitals that the British Army has, we have a roll two forward that we've discussed. So it has one ED bed, one surgical table, one ITU bed, but no capability to hold general ward. And this has been seen on operations such as Op Newcombe recently in Mali, where it's deployed quite successfully. And at the other end of the scale, we'll have a roll three field hospital, which we as 2-2 field hospital are mandated to hold at 30 days notice to move. So that's the biggest one that we do at this particular time, which is a 4-8-48 capacity. So in this case, we have four ED beds, two surgical tables, eight ITU beds. And there is a reason for eight ITU beds, which is linked to our ability to take chemical, biological and radiological patients in. And then finally, 48 bed spaces in the general ward bed. So as you'll note, between the two capacities, one is a little bit more agile and manoeuvrable, whereas the larger Roll 3 hospital, we would expect to be more fixed for a longer period of time. It's still manoeuvrable, but it takes in significant logistics to move it around the battlefield.
Sean Reeve there. Setting up a tented hospital facility in oftentimes harsh conditions can be a logistical challenge, and there are other problems posed by the environment. We asked Colonel Simon Lawrence, commanding officer of 203 Welshfield Hospital in Cardiff, if he could tell us about his experience of setting up a field hospital in a demanding situation.
I'm fortunate in that I've been deployed four times. I went to Iraq in 2003 and I've done three tours of Afghanistan. And delivering healthcare in an austere environment like that, and the first two were definitely austere. That was proper tents in the wind, damp dusting three times a day, was a challenge. It was a challenge clinically and a challenge militarily. But we were up to it and we had great training and great support. And it was very, very gratifying to be able to do. And the proudest thing I've ever done was to be deployed to Camp Bastion in the early days. We did it on a wing and a prayer, but we did it. The challenges are, it's an austere environment. The supply chain is extremely long and fragile. The environment that you're living in is hot, dusty, uncomfortable, potentially dangerous. All those things sort of mount up, but you have great support from friends, colleagues, and the Army generally, and the other two services, because we had Royal Navy and Royal Air Force personnel deployed with us as well. So it's extremely gratifying, and I'm extremely proud of what we've done. And we were the busiest and best trauma centre in the world in Camp Bastion when I was there.
The question of supply chains is an interesting one, in that supplies and materials that a hospital in the UK might take for granted cannot always be guaranteed in a difficult environment many hundreds or even thousands of miles away. As you might imagine, blood supplies are a key component for a field hospital, especially for trauma cases where hemorrhaging is an issue. Whereas at home, blood banks can be relied on with a steady supply of volunteer donors, out on campaign, this is much harder to secure. We asked Faye Lewis, biomedical scientist with 2-2 Field Hospital, how the supply of blood is managed, and she produced an intriguing piece of kit to explain it to us.
The item that I've brought is part of our emergency donor panel in EDP that we run, which is quite unique to the military in that the NHS, if you need to give a blood transfusion in the NHS, you would, it's all run through the donation service. You know, you go, you give your blood, they take that blood away from you, and then they will separate it all out into the different components, red blood cells, platelets, FFP, fresh frozen plasma. And that is then sent to the hospitals. And if somebody is bleeding in the hospital, they can send a sample to the lab and they will say, here's some red blood cells or whichever part you need. In the military, we do have that facility as well, to a degree. We hold a stock of red blood cells and a stock of plasma. The problem with platelets is they only survive for up to 7 days. So it's not very practical if you're in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the desert, you can't get those back from the UK. So we have an emergency donor panel. We screen those people before. So we ask who would like to give some blood. We screen those people. They answer exactly the same questions, you know, have you had a tattoo, that kind of thing that you would answer in the UK. And then we will say yes or no, whether or not we think we can take their blood. We find out what their blood group is. And then when we're out and we're deployed, if we get a patient who is bleeding a lot, maybe they need some platelets, we will take a blood sample from them and we will compare it and make sure that it will not have a reaction to one of those people on our donor panel that we've already screened. We'll screen them again to make sure nothing's changed. And as long as we're happy, we can take a unit of blood from them, and that is the whole blood, just literally take the blood straight out of their arm into a bag, and we will... Then it'll come to me in the lab and I will check that it's safe to give, that there's no infectious disease in there and that it won't react with that other person's blood, the patient. And then I can issue that to the ward that needs it and they can give it straight to that patient, a whole unit of blood, completely different to the NHS. It takes maybe an hour, so literally from being bled to being given, whereas if you think that's days at least in the NHS. So it allows us to give exactly what that patient needs in a much quicker turnaround time.
That was Sergeant Faye Lewis talking about blood provision within a deployed setting. The patient care pathway from the operating theatre to intensive care to recovery will be familiar to any of us who have been operated on in a civilian hospital. But we wondered what it looked like in a field hospital from a military perspective. Corporal Kevin Lawrence, who we met in the last episode, has been an operating department practitioner since 2018. We asked him about his role in patient care, and he too had a piece of equipment to help explain.
So my role within the unit is to act across four separate areas of the surgical field. So that is being a scrub practitioner, so assisting the surgeon, an anaesthetic practitioner who assists the anaesthetist. Also can act in the recovery role, so dealing with the soldiers post-surgery, and also CSSD, which is about cleaning and sterilising the surgical instruments after use.
You brought a piece of kit along with you, which looks really intriguing. Can you tell me a bit about it, please?
The piece of equipment I brought with me today is the e-ventilator, which is the new in-service ventilator in the Army Medical Service. Okay, this piece of equipment looks very similar to a large portable toaster with an 8.4-inch touchscreen and a green flashing LED in the handle, which tells us it's operating correctly. And this is essentially the way we can oxygenate our patients. In simpler terms, it takes over the function of your lungs. Yeah, along with this, we've got another piece of equipment called a DPAO2, which we can then use in conjunction to deliver anaesthetic gases to maintain anaesthesia in our patients.
I can see three buttons on the top of it, one of which shows an adult, but there's also children and babies. Are they used for them as well?
Yes, so this equipment, as you can see across the front, has got various quick access buttons. With this newer piece of equipment, we are able to ventilate premature and newborn babies, children, all the way up to adults. So this bit of equipment is very good. It can be used by operating department practitioners and anaesthetists further forward in the GMSG role. GMSG stands for Ground Maneuver Surgical Group, and then also be mounted into the Battlefield Ambulance in order to conduct critical care transfer of patients further back down the medical line. It's currently also used in civilian practice, again using critical care transfer, and by several of the air ambulance services across the UK.
Corporal Kevin Lawrence, speaking about work in the surgical unit and intensive care. In this episode, we've explored how a field hospital is set up when it is deployed and some of the challenges faced. But it's worth noting that the Army does not do this on its own, as it operates within the wider Defence Medical Services in tandem with the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy. Here's Captain Elliot Digby-Jones of Tutu Field Hospital.
It's important to understand that it's a tri-service environment. So all our three forces, so RAF, Navy and the Army as well. The hospitals that we pull from, so Frimley Park and our workforce in that, they tend to be mainly Army due to the type of specialities that are required. However, there are other aspects as well. So particularly how we integrate, you know, the field hospital is not just a thing in isolation. It's the pathway of, you know, patient pathway. So whether that's clearing them out the other end through air platforms, so we have integration with our RAF brethren, and also as well there could be some specialities that we require depending on the operational environment we go to, and that could be pulling from the Navy as well. So it all just depends on primarily what speciality of clinician or healthcare professional, and yeah, we just get them good to go.
Elliot Digby-Jones there, explaining the linkages between the Army, Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force when it comes to the medical services. In this episode, we have heard about the way hospital care facilities are deployed and the organisation and support required to do it. In the next episode, we speak to reservists, who make up about a third of Army Medical Services personnel.